New battery. Wow. Okay, how about that's enough probably, no? Yeah. Life is imperfect. Kind of very, very obvious thing to say. And yet, the degree to which we understand that truth is the degree to which we either live freely or live in the tyranny of struggling. We know life is imperfect. That things happen that we would rather not happen. And we know that many of those things are beyond our control. The people we love die, for example. Nothing we can do about it. We know there's nothing we can do about it. Things that we would like to happen sometimes don't happen. Things that we would like not to happen sometimes do happen. Things that we would like not, experiences that we would like not to have, sometimes we have. Experiences we would like to have, sometimes we don't. Life is imperfect. Okay, we'll see as we go along. So maybe I'll try and respond. Our friend said, well, maybe life is perfect, and we make it imperfect. So I'll try and refine what I'm pointing to when I say imperfect. Not always as we'd like it to be. And therefore, we start out with a condition where we have a hard time with that. Where we experience tension, difficulty, struggle, suffering, pain, confusion, grief. Grief, lamentation, and despair. One of the formulas the Buddha uses. Grief, lamentation, and despair. We experience when we end up having experiences we don't want to have, or not having experiences we do want to have. But what's very interesting in that natural process, right? Nobody ever managed, I was mentioning this the other day, to just have everything as they would like. Completely built in. Life doesn't organize itself around my wishes. It would be rather extraordinary, in fact it is a kind of rather extraordinary human arrogance, that I actually expect life to organize itself around my wishes. And then sometimes when things go wrong, I feel somehow cheated or let down by life. And that's what's significant. When things are not as we wish them to be, we think something's wrong. we tend to shut out whole areas of our life that we find difficult, uncomfortable, unwelcome, unwanted, and say that that's not okay. It's not okay to experience that. It's not okay to feel like that. It's not okay to be with that experience. It's not okay for my mind to be like that. It's not okay for my body to be like that. It's not okay for my emotional life to be like that. It's not okay for a situation to be like that. So we set up something, and the more rigid we are, the more tight we are, the more we hold on to fixed ideas of things, the more things we set up as being unacceptable, unmanageable, unbearable. So if we really explore that condition, we see that's a very, very difficult way to live. Given that our capacity to control our experience is very limited, right? We can't make it always as we'd like it to be, then it's a painful condition to split off whole great chunks of experience as not okay, not acceptable. So there's something very, very, this is the good news if you like, there's something very, very normal, very, very inevitable about the fact things that we don't like, that we experience bodily sensation, states of mind, that we experience people and situations that we don't like. It's normal. When I first started to understand that, it was an enormous revelation to me. Normal. Not something I need to freak out about. Because that's what we normally do, what we don't like. If we pay close attention, we freak out. We have a very wide range of sophisticated means for freaking out. Like blaming, one of the ways. We might blame ourselves. What have I done wrong? I feel I ought to be responsible. I ought to be able to be okay. I ought to be able to have a clear mind. You might have noticed just in being here around meditation, blaming. What's wrong with me? What's wrong with my body? What's wrong with my mind? We look around and we seem to think everybody else is wondrous, Buddha-like state. And sometimes people report their relief when they go. You go to a group and you hear somebody else say, "My mind's restless." Thank goodness for that. We're blaming ourselves. One of the ways we freak out. For some people, it's a kind of primary mode of operation. Criticizing oneself, blaming oneself, judging oneself, doubting oneself, hating oneself. Actually, kind of constant inner criticism of feeling I'm wrong, I'm doing wrong, I'm being wrong, I'm experiencing wrong, I'm acting wrong. Otherwise, often another way of freaking out is we blame others. It's your fault that I'm unhappy. I'm not pointing at anyone particularly. But basically, it's your fault. If we were pointing at anyone, we probably pointed at our families or our partners. They're the people we point at most often. But we can also point to colleagues, work. We can point to friends. Here on retreat, we can point to the person next to us, the person in front of us, the person we share a room with, or we can point to us guys up the front for daring to make you sit still for so long. Anyone you like. And we try to rather than seeing that it's normal that things are uncomfortable sometimes, we want to kind of lash out. We want to blame. We want to make it your fault. We want to give away the responsibility for our own happiness or well-being and make it your fault. And we build up a lot of kind of justification. We build up a lot of self. We build a lot of kind of hardness around that. Sometimes we just blame life in general. My mother used to have a kind of mantra that when things would go wrong, she'd say, "Typical." Very strange idea that this typical, as if it just proves that life's got it in for me. Not suggesting that my mother had any kind of extreme. I sometimes tell this story on retreat. And a couple of months ago, for the first time ever, my mother came on retreat with me. So suddenly I had to be really careful about whatever story there might be. But not that my mother is any kind of extreme example of that. But we might notice in ourselves, again, some way when things go wrong, that we make something of it that of, you know, that's a freak out. We blame ourselves, we blame others, or we somehow blame life. Some people call that blaming God. If some force we might refer to impersonally, typically, we might refer to personally as God, is somehow that life is somehow conspiring to make things difficult for me. And so, through not seeing that it's normal, that sometimes things are unpleasant or unwelcome or unwanted, through going through many, and blame is just one of the many complicated mechanisms of freaking out, we do our best to avoid what's unwanted and what's unwanted. We do our best to avoid suffering. You can notice how you relate to your experience when it gets uncomfortable. How you relate to your bodily discomfort after some time of sitting. It's very, very strongly hardwired into us, it seems. And we've learned through decades of experience and through decades of kind of education. I mean, just formal education, but the education from everybody else around us acting in the same way. We've learned to try and avoid suffering, even though suffering in some form or other, unwelcome, unwanted experience, in other words, is inevitable. So that whole complex was what the Buddha was most, most concerned with. Some religions are kind of concerned with what to believe, are concerned with a kind of metaphysics or a cosmology, a kind of ordering of the universe and how it came into being, and concerned with the nature of life and one life or many lives or one God or many gods or a whole kind of cosmological model. The Buddha said he was interested in one thing only: suffering and the resolution. And so his recognition was that rather than trying to avoid suffering, which he noticed he'd been doing for like the first 30 years of his life, how about actually exploring suffering? How about actually coming into a conscious relationship with suffering? See, what is it What is it in experience that makes it difficult? What is it actually that's hard to bear? What is it that actually, what am I actually doing in experience that makes it feel tight, rigid, difficult, pressured? What is it? What is that freaking out that we do? So there's the kind of formulation of that, which some of you will be very familiar with, as the Four Noble Truths. In fact, maybe I'd like to check. Maybe you could just raise your hand if this term, the Four Noble Truths, doesn't mean anything to you. If you're asking what I'm saying, that probably means the Four Noble Truths. So, central to all Buddhist traditions, it's kind of one of the few things, actually, believe it or not, one of the few things that all Buddhist traditions really agree on. And it might be surprising, but there's a lot of diversity within Buddhist practice and teaching. There's kind of differing definitions of emptiness, different understandings of karma, different descriptions of what compassion is, for example. I've just finished reading a very interesting book about Buddhism and sex, and the different teachings and different practices and different views about sex in Buddhism kind of throughout the ages, and some very very different ways of using or not using sexuality in Buddhism, from the kind of from celibacy one end, through the kind of tantric practices in the Tibetan tradition, and through the kind of crazy, horny Zen monks in some of the Japanese tradition. But I digress a little bit, but okay. So many aspects of it, it's not, Buddhism isn't homogenous in that way, but central and key and agreed upon, because it's so central, this model of the Four Noble Truths, which I'd like to just explore a little bit in light of our experience as way of an introduction to an exercise together, and not as something to necessarily understand, and certainly not as something to agree with or disagree with, to accept or reject, but really as something to explore and to inquire into in the light of what we find happening in our own experience moment by moment. So the first truth of suffering is that, very simply, that's in a way that's what we've been exploring until now, this first truth, that there is suffering, that life has unwelcome and unwanted experiences. And the Buddha said this is a truth to be understood, to be acknowledged. And the what's radical in that then is the movement and the invitation for us of the movement from freaking out, blaming, reacting, pushing against what we don't like, to actually understanding, oh, this is suffering. So when we're sitting and there's some discomfort in our experience, when our knee is uncomfortable in meditation, the difference between the pushing and pulling and wondering and panicking and imagining yourself, you know, there's still 20 minutes to go, and imagining of blood drying up and the leg withering and us kind of dragging our shriveled limbs out of the meditation hall. To actually acknowledge, oh, this is willing to inhabit the truth of the moment. Something kind of, there's a lot of humility to that. There's a lot of honesty to that. Something that sounds so simple and so obvious that there is suffering in life. We know that there's suffering. We know it in our own lives. We know it from the lives of those close to us. We know it from reading the papers. We know it. But it's one thing to know it as an idea. It's another thing to let, to kind of learn that on the cellularly, to learn that viscerally, to learn that in our moment-to-moment experience, so in such a way that it actually starts to change our relationship to it. Second truth is that there's a cause. Cause that we start to notice as we pay attention to the fact that there is suffering, the fact that there's tension, the fact that there's pressure, the fact that there's blame, the fact that there's all this freaking out going on, we notice that that freaking out comes from some idea that things ought to be different. And again, you just have to refer to the knee in meditation and see. We might ask ourselves, again, not as an idea, but really ask ourselves in the most intimate way we can in our experience, what's really hard to bear about that uncomfortable sensation? Is it the heat, pressure, tingling, density that's happening, changing moment by moment? Or is it the pushing against? Saying, no, no, not like this, not like that, this shouldn't be happening, that shouldn't be happening. Fussing, the pushing, the tightening, the rejecting. The contrasting our experience as it is to how we'd like it to be. But we do again and again and again. We set up some ideal, an ideal kind of fantasy land, wherein we feel peaceful, we feel happy, everybody likes us, they do exactly what we want all the time, etc., etc. And as soon as our experience doesn't correspond to that, we measure it against the ideal and find a sense of problem. But the ideal doesn't exist. So we might do it with the knee and we say, oh no, it shouldn't be like this. We might do it with our lovers or partners or friends. It shouldn't be like this. They ought to be do what I like, they ought to say what I like, they ought to, etc., etc. But they're not like that. So this kind of fixation of how things should be, we could say, is the distance between our ideal of how things should or could be and the way they actually are. That distance is the measure of our suffering. You understand when I say the degree to which we move away from the truth of our experience towards some version of how we think it should be is the degree to which we suffer over it. The cause of our suffering, and this is a hard truth, because it brings all the responsibility back to ourselves. The cause of our suffering is our freaking out. The cause of all, every single bit of what's hard to bear in human experience is the tightening, the blaming, the freaking out, the clinging to an ideal of how it should be. The messing with our experience. So the Buddha says this truth, this second truth, is to be abandoned. Abandoned. Abandon freaking out. Abandon the clinging. Abandon the idealizing. Abandon the insisting. Abandon the blaming. What is it?
Lintosh.
Third truth. There's an end. There's a resolution. There's a dissolution. This is the truth to be realized. That it's possible to meet our experience, whatever quality of experience, without freaking out, without blaming, without idealizing, without contracting, without tightening, without resisting, without blaming, without pushing, without freaking out, in such a way that we can abide freely with whatever the conditions are. Abide freely. Whether we like what's happening or not. We might be serious about doing something. Just because we don't like something, it's not like we just go, oh, well, nothing to do. Just got to accept it, mustn't freak out. No, in a kind of very passive way. But that what we do and how we meet our experience isn't driven by the tension, the stress, the tightness of reactivity. And then, last truth, the Buddha says, is a way to really cultivate heart and mind, cultivate our attention, cultivate our attitude, cultivate our behavior that actually undoes this knot, undoes these knots of reactivity, undoes the patterning that we've established over so many decades. Undoes the clinging, undoes the tension, undoes the stress. And then he points to the kind of a bunch of particular things which don't need to list necessarily, but points to the way of cultivating our understanding of how our experience works, cultivating our intentions, how we meet what. Cultivating our speech and the way that contributes to kind of intimacy with what's happening or with tightening or freaking out, etc. So certainly in the microcosm of meditation practice I see very much as a kind of microcosm of life, like putting our life under the microscope. That's what we're doing while we're here. We're doing all the basically normal things of life. We're sitting, eating, walking, talking, going to the lavatory, resting at night. Well, the same as every other day of life, really. We've tried to arrange the conditions in which we're doing that to be particularly supportive to paying attention. But basically, we're putting our life under the microscope. Saying, what's happening in my body? What's happening in my mind? What's happening in my emotional life? So meditation really is a tracking of these truths. It's a tracking of where, by just sitting, okay, let's just sit quietly. It's not like we're going out to try and cause ourselves suffering in order to explore it. Saying, no, let's just sit quietly and see what happens. Oh, my mind tends to go here and there. I start to get kind of obsessive about things. Oh, my mind seems to be out of control. Oh, my body seems to come up with all this discomfort. Oh, I seem to freak out a lot. So we're studying our suffering in the way that it naturally appears, like I say, not by trying to make it happen. We're studying our reactions to suffering. Studying the clinging, the freaking out, etc. We're also studying the capacity to meet our experience without freaking out. And we're training ourselves in what I was just calling undoing the knot of all. But it's not something that's just the provenance of meditation. Really, the study of suffering and the resolution of suffering is we're invited to explore in our whole life. That's certainly what this practice is about. This is the kind of concentrated version for a few days of exploring suffering, abandoning clinging, and realizing freedom. So, there's a lot more I wanted to say actually, but I also want us to have time to do an exercise. And the exercise really is to contribute in some way to us exploring, not, you know, we hear these four ideas of the Buddhas, and they may be familiar, they may be not familiar. They may seem helpful, they may not seem helpful. I'm not invested at all in you having, you know, coming up with, or remembering even these four truths. But I'm very interested in what do you know, or what can you find out about the way you meet your experience? Some of the ways we recognize clinging, some of the ways we recognize the freaking out, I was calling it. I just made a very brief list. And I was, you know, they came pouring out. I had to stop myself, or I would have just been, you know, I could have just read the varieties of freaking out. Rigidity. Getting rigid around our experience. Tension. Angst. That word, angst? Not quite the same as that anxiety. Okay. A kind of more a sort of existential concern. Stress, unease, pressure. Pressure around our experience, pressure on ourselves. Rejection. Rejection of what's happening. Not wanting to know, not wanting to feel. Denial. Not being able to acknowledge what's happening. Self-pity. Turning up as, oh, poor me, poor me, poor me, poor me. As if I'm just a victim of circumstance. Paranoia. Sense that there's something wrong, that suffering is kind of circling round, looking for me and bashing me every time it gets the chance. Compulsion, feeling we have to do that, have to do this, have to do that. Kind of endless need to interfere with our experience. And blame, which, you know, I kind of unpacked a little bit. So any of those we could unpack to quite, you know, some extent. The varieties of the ways we meet suffering are limitless. But what seems to be most central, most significant, what makes a difference is basically the way we generate stress and tension and intolerance around our experience. So that's why in the meditation just beforehand, I was encouraging you to really recognize the what I was calling ego tensions. The tensions that come from selfing around our experience. So heat and pressure and density is just going on in the knee, and then we say, oh, my knee, what do I need to do? What I mean by ego tension is the way we bring a strong sense of me and my knee and my problem and what I need to do. So, in the exercise, I want to really explore the ways we get into that. And those ways are limitless. So it's not really to explore them in an abstract way, but as closely related to what you're seeing now about your life, what you're seeing over these days, what you've known, maybe very immediate in terms of meditation experience, like I was just talking about knee pain. It may be the themes of your life that are standing out to you while you're here. You know, the stuff that's weighing on your mind about, you know, what, how you know you are in terms of patterns with your relationships or whatever's most current. So, first question. Tell me a way you get stressed. Tell me a way you get stressed. And the emphasis, I'm not, what's the Hebrew word you're using?
Meta.
So the English word stress, we tend to apply in lots of different ways, but often we could, it has the kind of connotation of when we have a lot of work to do. Oh, I'm stressed. So I don't know if metach has that same or if it has more a connotation of an inner condition. Good. Huh? Okay. So maybe the problem isn't there if you're speaking in Hebrew, but if you're using English to ask the question, I'm not so much interested in the external conditions. Oh, this condition causes me stress. I'm interested in how you get stress, how you generate stress, how you find yourself reacting. So stress in this tense, metta, is shorthand for rigidity, tension, angst, stress, unease, pressure, fear, rejection, denial, self-pity, paranoia, confusion, compulsion, and blame. To name a few. Tell me a way you...
What makes us all
this? Yeah, tell me a way you get stressed. In other words, tell me a way you tighten around your experience. Tell me a way you freak out inwardly around what's happening. So we could ask the question in those ways. Tell me a way you freak out about what's happening. Tell me a way you tighten around your experience. But just to keep the question rather simple and direct, we'll ask it like that. Tell me a way you get stressed. Okay. And just a reminder with the questions, if you're the questioner, there's nothing else that you get to say. Right? It's not, thank you, that's interesting. Can you tell me a bit more? No, it's just, tell me a way you get stressed, and the person, whatever they say, thank you. Tell me a way you get stressed. The way you can best support your partner is by sticking exactly, precisely, and completely to the script, and not by adding your own interjections. Okay. Second question. What's right about getting stressed? What's right about getting stressed? Now, if you've been listening to what I've been saying, you might think, well, there's nothing right about getting stressed. Right? But the question is a way of uncovering all the kind of more or less conscious or maybe quite unconscious ways in which we actually invest in our. Part of us believes there's very good reasons for tightening around things, very good reasons for freaking out, very good reasons for getting self-righteous, very good reasons for blaming. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. And sometimes we're not so aware what the driving forces are. So it's an opportunity to let yourself really explore that. Let yourself get into the way you believe, part of you believes, that it's a good idea to get stressed. It's a good idea to freak out. It's a good idea to get tight. It's a good idea to reject your experience. Yeah. Not so much the benefits, although you might speak about it in that way, but the way the question's framed, what's right about getting stressed? It's to uncover the kind of unconscious beliefs about what's right. So it might be, what's right about getting stressed? Oh, well, it helps me deal with things. If I didn't get tight around my experience, if I didn't, then I'd just kind of collapse and be some useless puddle and people would walk all over me. Thank you. What's right about getting stressed? Oh, well, as I say that, I see that it's a kind of defense mechanism. And actually, there's some kind of fear in there that of not protecting myself. Thank you. So it's just, so you're just letting yourself answer the question as you hear it, as a way to kind of explore your own defense mechanism, explore your own tightness, explore your own suffering. So, you know, it's kind of tender territory, some of this. It goes to the heart of a lot of the way we maintain and protect a kind of fragile sense of ourselves. So the quality with which you listen and support and just ask the question freshly again and again is a really great support for each other. So what's right about getting stressed? No, no, we'll go with that because we... We'll take 12 minutes for each question. So, we'll do the first question both ways, and then the second question both ways. And so that'll take 50 minutes. We'll add on a few minutes for, you know, using the bathroom or whatever. So please be back here by 6 o'clock. Is everything clear?